The Nick Scott Effect.
The Nick Scott Effect.
Available everywhere podcasts are found.
Man, Phil, thank you so much for joining me today. You look good in your studio there. I like it.
Thank you. Yeah, I got the rustic look, you know, like at the West Virginia look behind me. So appreciate that. And thank you for thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. And for those that don't know, you, by all means, are a professional violin, or if you're in the country scene, fiddle player. I like saying fiddle better. I think it rolls off the tongue better. So you've got quite an impressive social media following, almost a million followers on TikTok, it 60,000 on Instagram, and it's amazing. Can you maybe talk me through that? How did your social media just blow up so fast?
I mean, I think for myself, the kind of the long and short story is, you know, like a lot of people, I did the whole college band thing when I was, you know, much younger, and then, you know, got married. I have three young kids, and so, you know, life kind of happens and everything. And so for a long time, music was just on the side, something I did for fun. And then kind of the middle of 2019, I decided I really wanted to make a serious run at music again. And I was kind of working at the end of that year to kind of start lining stuff up and figure out what I wanted to do. And then, of course, the world shut down with COVID when 2020 started. And so I just wanted to keep that commitment to myself. So I started live streaming online. And so I did like Twitch and Reddit and TikTok lives. And then just through a series of like consistency and just getting after it day after day, it's like I would describe it as a series of like little wins. Then every now and then you get like a really big win, like a huge lift, excuse me. So, So I would say like I've had several videos, like, you know, whatever you want to call it, like blow up or whatever. But like for me, it was just a series of getting after it, doing a ton of live shows. So I perform online, and then people would come follow up and like look at my stuff after that. So that truly changed my life, like doing it that way.
That is incredible. I started a TikTok, I want to say about a year ago, and I think I've got like 500 followers. But I've got like 20,000 on Facebook, so I guess I'm old school. I guess I'm a dinosaur now. I'm still on,
you know,
Facebook.
TikTok's a grind, man. You know, like I think it like... Well, even honestly, even Instagram for me was a long, like it took a long time to grow. And then I think, I don't know where I'm at today, maybe like almost, I'm closing in on 300,000 on Instagram. And crazy. Last year was my biggest growth year on Instagram. It took a while, but like a lot of these platforms reward you for using like the tools that they're like coming out with. So when I started doing, you know, reels like every day or every other day, like it made it go, phew, it just started taking off. So.
That's incredible. Yeah. So take me back. You are a West Virginia native. You are from the town of Montgomery, which is just outside of Charleston. Yep. And did you go to school here in Charleston and college?
I went to, you know, all through middle school and high school. I was down in the Montgomery area at Boomer Christian, Boomer, West Virginia. Boomer, right on the Kanawha River, right next to Smithers, right 7 minutes from Montgomery. And, then I went to college in Tampa Bay, and I went to my undergrad at this small liberal arts school called Clearwater Christian, and then I did my MBA in marketing at the University of Tampa. So I like I played bands in college and did, you know, studio work here and there and stuff like that. Like music paid for about half of my college, and so I minored in music, but I was kind of nervous about doing the whole starving artist thing, because I had some friends that were doing that, and it didn't seem, it kind of scared me off of doing, because I love to write and sing and play and stuff, and it really scared me off of doing that, you know. So then I just kind of got into the corporate world. So that's, you know, that's kind of how I spent the last, I don't know, however many years. And then, like I said, a few years ago, I really made another run at music, and it ended up working out for me.
That's incredible, man. Now, where are you at today?
I'm in Detroit. Detroit, Michigan. Like south of Detroit, yeah.
So, are you familiar with a town by the name of Ypsilanti?
Yeah, I know exactly where that is. Yeah.
So, when I was 3 years old, we're taking it way back to the 80s, my dad was offered a job in Ypsilanti, and we moved there for about a year. I lived in Ypsilanti until I was four or so, and then we moved back to, I'm originally from Cincinnati, so the Cincinnati area.
Nice.
But I don't have a lot of memories, but I can say I lived there. So what took you from Tampa to Detroit?
So my wife was teaching elementary school at the time, and she was pregnant with our first child. And so she had already not renewed her teaching contract. And then one day, this is like maybe a few months before the baby's born, my boss walks in one day as a small software company in Tampa. He's like, "Hey guys, good news for me is I'm selling this company. Bad news for you." So he's like, "I'm selling it in 90 days. So if you can find something, find something." So, you know, I was freaking out. You know, we got our first baby on the way. My wife didn't renew her teaching contract. And so I was looking everywhere high and low for something in Tampa. I just couldn't find either like a monetary fit or whatever. And so through a series of some events, I got offered a job to kind of transfer or move up here to the Detroit area, which is where my wife is from. And okay. it was too good not to at least try. So we're like, all right, nothing's permanent. Let's go. And so this was probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago now. We did that. And then it's a little cold for me here. I'm not like super in love with the Midwest weather, like the winter and everything, but you know, it's not a bit like, so now I kind of like, now that music's taken over my life, like, you know, like I said, I have young kids in elementary school and stuff. So we're kind of like, I'll be the one that's inconvenienced for now. I will travel for touring and gigs and stuff like that. And we'll see where it all takes us. But for now we're kind of based in Michigan and I just kind of tour and travel as I need to.
Now, you've mentioned playing on studio work, doing studio work, and touring. Are there some bands, acts, folks that you have recorded with or toured with that we'd be familiar with?
Yeah, I mean, I have hundreds of session credits to my name. So people like probably my biggest ones, like last year I got to be on Noah Kahn. He's a pretty big like folk Americana artist. I got to do a couple tracks on his album. I've done a ton for country artists like Brandon Davis and I've done everything from like lo-fi projects, cool stuff like that, hip hop, you know, whatever, a ton of indie music. And then I'm also a singer songwriter. I do the artist thing as well. And so kind of the formula that has worked for me is, you know, especially when I was first getting going, is I would feel like everybody and their mother would get up with a guitar and like sing a song that they wrote on these online platforms. And I do that too, but I had to be like, well, what is something that I do that makes me stand out a little bit differently? And so that's how I started just playing the fiddle over like anything people would request. It doesn't matter, any genre, any song. And so then I would get my audience built up really big and I'd be like, all right, hey, let me play you something I wrote. Let me play something I wrote. And then I started introducing my original stuff that way, which is kind of how I built my fan base, just like over time, you know, one or two fans at a time. And then it really kind of snowballed. So when I tour, this is a very long answer to your question, but when I tour, it is for mostly for the singer-songwriter stuff. You know, so I'll go play events, and then if I do a lot of like corporate gigs and charitable events too. And so sometimes for that stuff, I'll do a mix. I'll, you know, play the fiddle, and then I'll play my stuff and whatever else. So it just depends on kind of what comes my way.
Do you have any tour dates coming up that would take you this way? I'm in the West Virginia area.
So I'm going to be, I was just in Morgantown really recently I've done a lot of stuff with the people at WVU have been very good to me, the WVU Foundation and stuff like that. I've done several events for them. I'm going to be back March 17th. I'm going to be opening for this band called The Clarks in Morgantown at Milan Park. And then in Charleston, I don't have a public event. I'm doing the Thomas Health Foundation. They have a big gala at the Clay Center every year. So I'm playing at the Clay Center for them. And so I'm working on more in the area. So it just depends on, you know, I'm kind of like adding stuff all the time. So I'm still indie and like doing all of my own pretty much management. Because I've said no to a few things. I haven't found the best fit yet. So I kind of like pick and choose what I want to do. And, you know,
I also don't want to be done like all the time. Have you had the ability to play the Clay Center before?
No, this will be my first time.
So I just played there this past Saturday. I was a part of one of me and my friend EJ. We do a DJ squad together. Something I didn't tell you before is I'm also I'm a professional turntablist. So I turntable DJ. And we did an event that they hold called Carnival every year.
Sweet.
And it was me and him. We rocked one room, and they had two bands, one on the stage and one in the theater. So you had two DJs in one area throwing a big like rave party, and then you had two bands to other rooms. So and I've done a lot of like formal events, weddings, private parties, things like that at the Clay Center over the last 15 years. Yeah. Beautiful venue.
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful venue. And the audio and visual staff there, the AV staff, the production crew, they're top notch. So
yeah, that's what I heard. Like I just had the huge honor. This was like January 15th. I got invited to play at Mountain Stage. So I got a feature on Mountain Stage. It was really awesome. And then I spent a lot of time talking with the folks there. And one of the guys that works in sound at the Cultural Center was like, have you played the Clay Center yet? And he's like, dude, the staff over there, like, they're so great. It's like, mm-hmm. everything's like kind of top of the line, blah, blah. So I've heard that from multiple people. So I'm definitely looking forward to playing there.
When is it? When's the event? You're here?
The Thomas Foundation, excuse me, I think it's like May 28th or May 25th, okay. Something like that. It's in May. So.
Well, when you're in, you'll have to hit me up and we'll come down and say what's up. I'd like to meet you in person.
Yeah, for sure. And I might do the, you know, because I played the Empty Glass, like, after the Cultural Center.
Oh, yeah.
So, and I know those guys from, like, the Carpenter Ants and stuff. So I might try and play the Empty Glass as well, just while I'm in town. So I'll definitely let you know.
The Empty Glass, for those who might listen, I have listeners all over the country. The Empty Glass is one of those bar/music venues. It's very small, very intimate, but it's got a legacy. It's got a very long-standing legacy. And it's one of those places here in the Charleston, West Virginia area that's like, if you're a musician, you almost have to play there once or twice to pay it some homage. You know what I mean?
Oh, 100%. And I thought it was so rad. Like, you know how Mountain Stage, like, Basecamp Printing does, like, the poster for every show? Like, they have this, like, beautiful, like, full-color poster. And so the show I was on was to kick off the 40th season of Mountain Stage. And, like, the design on the poster is the Empty Glass. Like, they were paying homage to the Empty Glass.
Oh,
so it was,
awesome.
Like, for me being, like, from there and, like, being a musician from the Charleston area and from West Virginia, like to play my stuff on Mountain Stage, like, was very, like, emotional and rewarding.
Sure.
But then, like, then I got to go play the Empty Glass, and I was like, this is, like, the coolest 1-2 punch of my life. This is just very surreal, you know? So it was awesome.
So your TikTok videos, I watched a lot of them, and mm-hmm. you're a very talented fiddle player.
Thank you, man.
And I don't have to tell you that. And there were a few there where you played over Country Roads and Named by Goo Goo Dolls. So do you rehearse a lot of that, or do you is that purely on the fly?
No, I mean, of course there are songs that get requested over and over that I've heard before or played a million times. But I will say that, like, I would say a fair percentage, let's say 98% of songs that I get, requests that I get, things like that, I do one listen, one take. So I basically listen to the song while I'm tuning up. I listen to the song while I'm getting my violin out or my fiddle, whatever. And then I put my headphones in and I close my eyes and I just play whatever I'm feeling. You know, so, but typically that, for me at least, typically that's kind of like, I'm having a conversation, like, with the song, you know? And so a lot of times I feel like the best output is just, like, that feel that you can, like, it's hard for me to explain. I kind of see it.
No,
that's why I close my eyes so much. I kind of see it, you know, in front of me, and then I just kind of just, it's like I'm chasing it through a maze almost, you know, just kind of following the song and see what happens.
When did you start playing the violin? At what age?
I was been playing the fiddle since I was 4 years old.
Oh my gosh!
So
when I was four, I don't know if I could wipe my own hind.
I know. Like four, you know. And I mean, it wasn't like I was practicing an hour a day, like. But I would do like one like 20-minute lesson a week. And actually, a shout out to Dr. Fred Meyer. He's my first music teacher, and he was. It was WVU Tech West Virginia Tech at the time in Montgomery, and he led the music department. And so my first violin teacher was a professional oboe player. He did not play the violin,
okay. Yeah.
But he had like the instruction books and everything else. He knew enough to kind of get me going. And I don't know. I mean, it always just made sense to me. Like, I always have, like, there's times like in middle school and stuff, like, you know, you don't want to practice, you don't want to play, but I've always got so much joy from. Like, it honestly feels like it's a part of me. Like, when I play the guitar, I still have to, like, really focus. And, like, it requires a lot more mental gymnastics for me to play and sing the guitar. I get a little more nervous when I play the guitar. But the fiddle, like, it's almost just, like, it's like another arm. You know, I just played it for so long that it's just, you don't have to think about it as much, which is a beautiful thing. You don't have to think it's so kind of roll with
did
it.
Did you continue lessons as a child, or when, yeah. when did you get to the point where you felt like you no longer needed instruction?
I still need it. But I would say, I don't think that ever stops. Truly, I really don't think that ever stops. Like, you learn every day. And I would say, I taught, like, in high school, there was, she lives in Colorado now, but she was a violinist for the West Virginia Symphony Orchestra. Her name was Catherine Langer. And so I took lessons from her all from, like, middle school all the way up to college. Like, that was way more serious, like, playing. And I played the West Virginia Youth Orchestra and stuff like that. And then, so shout out to Dr. Bob Turizani. He was the director of the symphony. And then I, like I said, I minored in music. So I got a music scholarship for about half of my tuition. And so I had lessons all through college too. So like I didn't stop taking lessons until I was like through college. And then, yeah, so I guess for like 18 plus years, I was having lessons like all the time.
All right, guys, this episode of the podcast is sponsored by the Appalachian Outpost. They're located in Lyburn, West Virginia. If you're familiar with the town of Logan or Mann, West Virginia, it's literally right in between the two. And it is a resort that is customized for your trail rider, your side-by-side, your four-wheelers, your big souped-up Jeeps and rock crawlers. They have cabins, so you and your crew, no matter where you're from, you could come down to Lyburn, haul your toys along with you on your trailers, have a wonderful cabin to stay in that feels just like home, and you get up in the morning, you hit the trail. The trailhead rock house, I had to think about it for a second, is right there near the Appalachian Outpost. So you can literally hit the trailhead and go ride. And then when you come back, they got dinner waiting on you at the Broken Axle. My friends Leah and Fuji own the Broken Axle. It's a bar restaurant that is absolutely delicious. So book your reservation now for you and your riding crew at theappalachianoutpost.com.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. It's funny, what led me into the path of broadcasting was music. I remember being about 7, 8 years old. My dad was a preacher. Yeah. And in our church, we had a piano and a drum kit. That was it.
Yep.
And so I remember picking up the drums and learning how to play like a 4-4 beat or something.
Love that, yeah.
And when I was about 13, 14, a guy brought a guitar into the church. First time I ever seen a guitar. Mm-hmm. And I was drawn to it. So he taught me some chords. I started playing. When I was 18, I was signed to a minor record deal with a band I was in, a rock metal band. That only lasted like a year. We put out a 7-song EP. Sweet. And then, but I kept playing. And then I transitioned into turntablism and DJing. Actually, I have it right here if you want to see it. My wife got me one of the best Christmas presents I've ever gotten. Hold on, I'll show it to you.
Let's see it.
A 2013 Les Paul Standard.
Oh, heck yeah, dude.
Look at that, man.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful too. I love when those have like that color knobs with the sunburst on the front. Like, I think it looks so good together. Those are beautiful instruments.
So now this year's model, it had a circuit board in here instead of like the hand wound soldered pots. And I actually just got this back from Pod Piper. Shout out to Tanner and Dave at the crew at Pod Piper. And so they put hand wound soldered pots in here and took the circuitry out, and it sounds amazing.
Yeah, those things are mine's over there. I like to play electric, but I mainly play acoustic because of what I do. And so for the longest time I had like, I really like Martins, and I had a Martin DC-1E, which is a great guitar. And then I had this one guitar I've been wanting for like, I don't know, for as long as I can remember. It's a Martin D41, like sunburst with like the inlay all down that. And it's got like the Martin logo. That's like, the long, almost looks like a cross. It's like the CF Martin on the thing. And it's a true beauty. And I'm not going to get this guitar until like whatever happens. And so
retirement age.
Exactly. But then like stuff started happening with music, and I was like, oh my gosh, like I think I can actually do this. Like, this can not do this and barely live, but like I can support my family and like really do this for real. And so I got invited in last summer. It was like definitely just a true honor. I got a call from the Bluebird Cafe to come and feature and play.
Oh, wow.
In Nash. So like that was a huge honor. And And so, like, when I was in Nashville, I went to Green Guitars, and I got that, my dream guitar. And I'll play, and so the first time I ever played that in front of people was at the Bluebird. So, like, that was just a cool, like, you know, moment. Because, as you know, like, every time I go to Nashville, my wife will look in the car and be like, all right, you're leaving with two instruments. Let's try and come back with just two instruments, please. Because, like, I could, man, I could go buy a guitar and a fiddle, like, every time. I, like, I love sure. instruments, but, you know, you got to contain yourself a little bit.
Upstairs, I have a new Taylor. I like Martins, but I'm also a Taylor guy. So sure, yeah. acoustic, it's up in my bedroom, but I've got a Taylor. It's a 314 CE Koa Deluxe. Sweet. It's the Koa wood. So I am very blessed these days. My life, music playing as far as guitars. I play with a local church here in Charleston called Bible Center.
I know it well. Yeah.
So,
shout out to my cousins, the Garibes. Team. You know the Garibes?
Oh, I do. I know the Greaves. Yep.
Yeah. So Heather's my first cousin.
Oh, okay. Cool. Heather, well, shout Mitri out to and, Heather and the Greave and crew.
Yeah. That's I know a lot of Bible Center folks for sure.
So I'm actually playing this Sunday. I've actually got to do some practice in here at home. I'm playing both services early in the evening, but acoustic. So I'll take the Taylor out to that. And it's funny. I took almost a 20-year hiatus from the guitar, focusing. Sure. on my DJ service and business and building that small business and putting myself out there for bookings and then my radio career and then my production and doing stuff for satellite radio and so forth. And last year, almost a year exactly in March, we all got COVID and we were all stuck in the house.
Of course.
And I was going nuts. I was going crazy. And I'm going to tell on myself here a little bit. I broke quarantine by Wednesday because I couldn't stand to sit here any longer.
Yeah, I get
and
it.
And just got up. Wild hair and went and bought a cheap $200 Dean acoustic guitar. And first one I've had in 20 years, and it just came right back like I never stopped. And that went from a Dean to a Yamaha and a Yamaha to a Taylor, and then I traded that Taylor into the nicer Taylor. And
yeah, that's all good.
I bought a Squire that went to a Fender American, and then the Fender American went to the Gibson Les Paul. It's like, anyone knows anything about instrument buying, it never, ever stops.
That's 100%. I think I was 18 in my freshman year of college, and a bunch of my buddies were like playing the guitar and singing stuff they wrote. And I loved writing and everything. I was like, man, but I can't do that and play the fiddle. And so I would like steal my friend's guitars all the time. Like I had a buddy, my friend Mike had like this beautiful Martin, and I would like steal anybody's acoustic guitar and I'd just go try to like figure it out and sing and play. And so that summer for my 19th birthday, my dad got me my first acoustic guitar. It was a Fender. It was one that came in like a multi-pack, you know, with a DVD, probably a $300 guitar. And it had this like old guy in a ponytail. You could put on the DVD player and you just follow him like playing. And I wore that thing out. And it took me, because like going from no frets to frets is what kind of tripped me up. And then it was like after like a few months, it was just like the light went on. I was like, oh, like I see. And so I have loved the guitar ever since then in a different way. Like I love the guitar because you can sing with it and really you can really perform in a different way. So I have a lot of love for acoustic guitars. They make me happy.
Have you ever tried a fretless guitar?
I have tried. I've seen fretless bass, and I had a friend who played classical guitar, like the real deal, you know. And he had this. I don't forget. It was like a foreign instrument, like a Spanish instrument or something, but it was a fretless classical acoustic guitar.
Oh, wow.
And it was really, really this really weird, interesting looking unit. But I've never tried to play the guitar without the frets. But you know.
So when you are, walk me through this, being a guitarist and being used to having the fretboard and, and my brain, I kind of think in the box, you know what I mean? I'm usually in like a 4-fret box.
Okay.
How, when you're playing the violin, do you know where you're at, what key you're supposed to be in the pitch? You just get used to where your hand's supposed to be.
Yeah, that's the harder thing. So, you know, I forget what the exact measurement is, but let's say every like eighth of an inch. I mean, it's very small on the violin is a different tone, even like down to like almost like semitones, where like you know you can or these like kind of like in between. So you have to kind of learn. You know, okay, where's a C sharp? Where's a C? Where's a D? Where's a D flat? Whatever it is. And so that's why the violin is so hard to learn. And so you'll see a lot of kids when they first learn the violin, they have the like little tapes on the fingerboard. So they'll learn like one key first or one position first. And sure. then the great thing about the viol, like string players, a lot of them have great ears because like it's not as like to me, the guitar feels very forgiving because I can land in anywhere in the fret and kind of slot into home base. You know, I'm like, okay, like I'm there. Good enough. But like there's no good enough with the violin. If you miss it, you miss it. You know, and people can hear it really clearly. So like it definitely the biggest gift that the fiddle has given me is like that kind of really sharp, you know, relative pitch and intonation and all that kind of stuff. Cause you have to have it. Otherwise you won't know. You know, like you said, you won't know.
Sure.
You have to know what note you're playing and where it falls in the circle of fifths and all that stuff, you know.
Do you remember the first song you learned on the fiddle?
Yeah, I think it was probably, probably like Mississippi Hot Dog. It's like one of those like, you know, bum, 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 bum. It's like Twinkle Little Star, but with like 16th notes, you know? And I remember when I was five, I used to go to the Vandalia Gathering in Charleston every year. And my dad would just like throw me in the group of pickers and be like, I'll just play what they're playing, you know? And so like I did the fiddle contest every year. And I remember when I was 5 years old, my mom has a video somewhere. I played Camp Town Races for the fiddle contest at the Vandalia Gathering, and I thought I was like the coolest kid. But that's like, that's as a musician,
the coolest kid.
That's the drug, though. You know, like when you are on stage and you feel like the energy from people coming to you, like that is what, at least for me, I was like, oh, this is it. Like, this is it. You know, I can live off of that.
It's hard to explain that to people. I found myself in that same moment. There have been people that have come to me and asked me why I've never really tried to go back into live terrestrial radio in the last 6 years. And I never got that feeling from being on the air. Live performances as a DJ or even playing music. But I remember just having like hundreds of people, a couple thousand people just bouncing and vibing to what I was doing on the turntables. It's not an ego thing. When you feel that coming back to you from a crowd of people, I don't know of any other experience of feeling in this life I've had that feels like that. And it's a drug. It's addicting.
It totally is. And that's how it's different. Like my dad he still does like all the music at our home church, and he was like the music director. He didn't play any instruments really, but he did the choir and the,
what's the name of the church?
Boomer Baptist.
Boomer?
It's small Baptist. small little church down in Boomer.
Boomer so, Baptist. I love it. Shout out to Boomer Baptist.
Yeah. BBC baby. So like I like played in church my whole life. Of course, you know? And if you like lead, not to go down a rabbit show, but when you're like leading a worship session or something like that, it's different, but it's still similar to that, but it's different because it has a different meaning to it. And like, but it still is that same feeling of like this big unity of people. And I think that is why people like not like attending concerts so much, because like you are like gathering around this common interest up there on the stage. And then you're experiencing something together that's only going to happen one time, exactly how it's going to happen. You know, I might go play a song five different ways, five different gigs. So I think that's the beauty of playing live, is that anything can happen. And then you share that emotional experience with everybody. And then when you're an artist and you hear people like singing words back to you that you wrote, it's like it's almost too much. Like at Mountain Stage, the crowd was so great, and doing it at hometown, I had this big thing lined up to say at the end of my set. And I got people like stood, it was like a standing O, and I got really choked up. And I looked over and Kathy Mateo was on the stage, and she just looked at me and she was like, wow. And like, she just came over and gave me a hug. Like I couldn't even speak. I was so like overcome with like, this is like what you dream of. You know what I mean? Like when you are sitting in front of your mirror writing a song and you're like, yeah, the crowd goes wild. Yeah. Like that's what you dream of, you know? So,
and then it happens.
That's the beauty of music. That's for crazy. Sure.
So one thing, and to kind of pony off of that, you know, having that feeling we just discussed in a quote unquote secular fashion is wonderful. What I also found even more meaningful is, so when I
was very blessed and asked to play along with Bible Center's worship team back in July when I started.
Yeah.
And I think it was in September, October. I know the guys watch this, so guys, I'm sorry if I missed the data, but we did a night of worship, and it was a full hour of nothing but music. We did like 15 songs.
Beautiful.
And it was on like a Thursday night. It was a week night. It wasn't a normal church night. And we had a bigger crowd than even our worship pastor, Caleb, had anticipated.
Yeah.
I tell you all this because not only was that mind-blowing, but after, I got messages on my social media that were like, hey, you know, this is going on in my life, and it's tough right now, you know, job or maybe a husband-wife or a kid or something. Life's tough right now. I saw you post about the night of worship. I decided to check it out. And man, like that healed me that night.
Yeah.
Like that night I felt peace. And that to me,
it's incredible.
Was just as great of a feeling that we could help people in those tough times.
I think that is so true because too, like what you're saying, like, you know, sometimes you will get but it's especially like in a sacred setting like that, right? Where you have like a common set of beliefs and, you know, it's very healing for people just to like experience that and like it's an intimate shared setting with like however many people are there, 100 people, 1,000, you know? And I just think that's like such a thing that is so, that is like the true gift of what music I really believe was like created for, is that like it speaks to us in a different way. It's just like the fiddle, like, it's one of those instruments that like really pulls at those heartstrings. You know, like when you hear that slow fiddle or like whatever, the Ashokan Farewell, songs like that, Amazing Grace on a violin. Like that's why people like want a violin at a wedding or at a funeral or things like that, is because it's so emotional, you know? And that's really such an interesting thing. I wish everybody could experience that once in their life, like how you can experience it when you are kind of at the steering wheel of that, like whether you're leading worship or you're playing at a show or whatever, like I wish everybody could like experience that feeling, because it's truly I've never felt anything else exactly like that in other things that I've done.
There have been times where, you know, I'm stressed out, you know, say I got some projects going on, or it's a busy week with gigs, you know, I'm DJing here and there, whatever, and you know, and there's life. I've got two kids as well. They're both under 10, and I'm married, and there's home projects we're working on. We're painting tomorrow upstairs. So, you know, life is stressful. And I remember going into church like, all right, you know, I got this to do today. I got this to do, blah, blah, blah. But I need to knock this out. I got to get my head right, get my music, and just kind of get in that mindset, that moment. And 100%. It brings me joy and peace and heals that daily stress. And I'm sure you feel that too when you're doing shows or
playing It's exactly, and I was talking about this with also everything's connected in West Virginia. So you know Matt Garrison, of course. So Matt.
So
Andrea is also my first cousin you know, Heather and Andrea are first cousins. So like, both of their dads are brothers to my dad. If that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah. So anyways, Matt Garrison is one of the nicest and greatest guys at Bible Center. Good dude.
Yeah, and Matt Garrison grew up like 5 minutes from where we now live in Michigan, which is just is a weird small world. So anyways.
Yeah.
But like, of course, they all came to Mountain Stage, but we were talking about like the whole music thing and how it's just like, I don't know. It's a beautiful thing, man. It's a blessing to be able to do it anytime. Like anytime I can go do a show and anything like that. Like, it's just like, it just feels like, man, like I'm getting paid for this. Like I just love doing it, you know? And, anyways, yeah, it's a really cool thing.
You know, I had a friend of mine in high school growing up that never cared for music. And I remember I was always a music nut, and me and him were best friends, and we had similar interests in a lot of other things. We played football. We liked Mortal Kombat and video games and wrestling back in those days, you know, the Attitude Era and all that.
Yeah.
But he was never into music. And I often think about that, you know, and I even asked him about it. He didn't have I don't know, I just don't care, you know. And that always was wild to me, because music has always been so impactful to my life and to me. So to not care about music has always been just so strange. Have you ever encountered anybody like that?
Yeah, a couple people. Like, I've had friends like that where they'd be like, oh, I just don't put on whatever you want. I don't really care. I don't really have a preference. You know, like those kind of things. I'm like, man, like, because I'm either like, I listen to a lot of, I love to read. I love books too. But like, I either always have on music or an audiobook or something like that. And I like want music all the time. All the time. And I love discovering new stuff. And I love, like, I just finished recording my first like full length album. And I recorded it up in Bridgeport. Oh, wow. And one of the goals of my album is I wanted to do as much as humanly possible, like sourced from West Virginia / Appalachia. So all the session players, blah, 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 from the region. But like even that creative process, like the first day we were there, like we were doing like days like, you know, 9 to 9, 9 to midnight, you know, sometimes just to get it all done. But it doesn't feel like a day at the office in the old days where you'd be like, oh man, I had to work 12 hours today. Like this was terrible. Like I'm tired, but I'm like, it's my favorite thing to do. So like I could just keep going. This is so great. Like let's keep writing, let's keep playing, you know, whatever.
When you said Bridgeport, did you mean Bridgeport, West Virginia?
Yeah, yeah.
Zach
McCord is the producer, and the studio is in like Clarksburg, Bridgeport, West Virginia.
What is the name of your album, and is it out now?
No, it will be out. The name of the album is going to be called Old Kanawha, named one after one of the songs. And then it's got like really awesome features on it, like my buddy Charles Wesley Godwin is a feature on one of the tracks, and a couple other bands are featured on it. And it's going to be about 13 songs, and like I have a lot of singles out right now, but this is the first like full body of work. And so like I've been able to like really resource like a lot of great talent to like Basecamp is going to do some posters there in Charleston. I'm working with some hopefully work out where I'm working with some designers like Kinship Goods and things like that will help get the design. Because my goal seriously with this album is like if I can do it in WV, I'm going to. And then I have a mastering engineer I really have always loved working with. So it'll get the final mix and master done in Nashville. And then it's going to be out in like June. So I'll do like a single in March, a single in April, a single in May, and then put out the whole album in June.
Well, please keep me in your contact loop when you put it out, and I'd be happy and honored to kind of get the word out and
showcase
your music.
Thank you. Absolutely. Yeah, much appreciated.
So one thing, I've had a lot of artists on. I've had guys from Byzantine. I've had Chase Mitchell, who's blowing up the country charts now. Mm-hmm. I've had Kate Boytek, who's from Logan, on. Sahaj Tikatin from the band Ra. One thing I love about musicians is their approach to songwriting. So approach to songwriting, where do you draw inspiration? Is it just daily things that you encounter?
That's such a great question. I think that, well, one, I think the reason that my songwriting has been successful this time around is that, like, you know, one of my college bands was called Yesterday's Tomorrow, so shout out to those guys. But, you know, we're writing, I mean, you know, at least for myself, not that you can't write great when you're 18. I wasn't writing great. So, like, now that I'm, like, you know, married, I've experienced, like, some loss in my life, and I have young kids and, you know, different things that have happened, I draw a lot from, I really try to write what I'm super passionate about. So I write a lot about, you know, either like places or people or life experiences that I've had, and try to do it in a way that's, you know how like when you first start writing songs, it's almost too specific. We're like, it might be good to you or the five people that know you, but if you were to put it out there, nobody would know what you're talking about. Like, it's way too specific. So you have to get really good at that art of being generally specific to where everybody can really relate to the song, but it still has a deep personal meaning. And so my approach a lot of times is I'll have an idea, and then a lot of times I will think of the melody first. I'll just do like gibberish or whatever, and then I'll start like popping in words from this idea into the melody. And then sometimes they happen really fast, and sometimes a song takes me, like the last song for this album, I had been sitting on this idea for like over a year, and I just could not get it right. And then literally like the day before I was to go for my very last set of sessions, I finished it, and I was like, oh, sweet, I'm going to put this one on there. You know, like, I finally finished it, but some stuff, you know, you start writing, and it's just like, it's like it was there all along, and the whole thing comes out in, like, 30 minutes. You're like, that's beautiful. So I just try to ride that wave.
when you write, do you write the violin, the acoustic, and the vocal, or
no? So I do the whatever the like accompaniment instrument is. So I've written a couple songs where like I sit at the piano and mess around. Most things I write using the guitar. So I'll write the guitar, I'll figure out the chord structure, all that stuff. And then I don't mean this to sound cringy, but what I like to try to do is, like, the first time I play the song on the fiddle is when I walk into the studio. It's like I've heard it a million times, and I've got these little ideas in my mind, and I'm just like, all right, let's just run three or four of these things back to back to back to back to back. Just don't talk to me. Let me just play five in a row. And then, then, like, you know, after the second time, I'm like, oh, I really like this. Let me try this motif or that motif. And that's how I write the parts for the fiddle. I just try to, like, pull it out of me. And I'll do between three and five takes in a studio, and I'm like, oh, I love that. Let's go with that. And then I'll do, like, a harmony string part and something like that, you know.
So if we were to talk to Philip Bowen in 5 years from now, we had a crystal ball, where do you think you'd be?
You know, hopefully, I think where I will be is... I will have done, you know, more major shows. I really believe that is going to happen. Like, I've got so much traction this past couple of years. It's been a really wonderful year for the artist side of my life. And so there are a couple of, like, dream gigs that I want, places I want to play still. Like, Mountain Stage is one of them, so that's off the list. But, like, I would love to play a song that I wrote in the circle at the Opry. So that going to happen. That is going to happen. Yeah. And then I would also love to play the Ryman in Nashville. Like, that's always been like a huge dream of mine to do that. So I would say in 5 years, I will have released a total of 3 albums, and I will have done some major touring, and, you know, music will still be a big joy for me. And
I'm hoping when you get to that level, you remember Nick Scott, and we have that conversation, because I'm going to save this.
That's right. I'm trying to, like, speak it into existence. You know, like, yes, it's happening. There you go. Know?
Have you been to the Ryman?
I've been there. Yeah, I've been there before. Oh, and I've been to Nash plenty, like, you know, to play and record and everything. And I would just love. And I've been to the Opry too. Like, I would love to do it. I have people that I know, like, music acquaintances that are making their Opry debut this year and, like, things like that. So, like, it's totally possible. My big thing right now is like I'm still doing mostly everything. I have a couple of people that help me out with, like, the admin side of my world, but you know how it goes, man. Like, when you start making a lot of noise, like, people start coming knocking on your door, whether it's, like, artist management or booking management. And so, and it's like, this is like my baby, or I built basically, it's like a small company, so you build it from the ground up. And I just am so, like, hesitant to, like, not that I don't trust anybody, but I want to find the right fit, you know, like, the right fit, because I do see it. I definitely see, like, an advantage to, like, major label support or really great artist management. I just haven't found the fit that I'm ready to say yes to yet. So,
I think that's very special and smart of you. So this episode, I don't know what it is, but I think you're like my 54th episode or something, 55, something like that. And in the last 2 months, I've been approached by 2 networks wanting to put my podcast on their network.
Sure.
And put it out there and market it and everything. And I haven't told them no, but I haven't returned their calls either. You know, because, like you said, this is your baby. This is, you know, you build this and you're in charge of it, and you have the creative control of it. And I'm in a place kind of like you where it's like, I'm going to keep my, you know, nose to the grindstone, keep it going, and see where it happens. I think that's very smart of you. The only thing that would scare me, someone in your position as a musician, is selling over or giving over your music rights to
I literally had this conversation. Like, I've had labels approach me about, like, a distribution deal. So for the people listening, that's where, like, somebody, for example, do a little music industry talk here. That's where somebody wants to buy your entire back catalog, which means everything that you've already released. So here's a sample of that. Like, somebody said to me, hey, we want to buy your back catalog for 5 years, and we'll pay you this, whatever the advance is, write you a big check. And then after we get that advance back, then you'll get your royalties, whatever percentage you all agree on. And the thing about that is that, like the deal wasn't that great, because I was like, well, that's, I'll do that in 2 years. I don't need your help with that. But, like, I was talking to, It doesn't matter. Yeah. So I was talking to like I haven't had a lot of great experience with A&R people yet. You know, on the artist side, I've had wonderful experiences. I haven't had like the best experiences on the industry side. So I'm talking to this A&R person. This person is literally nothing wrong with being young, but this person had literally like probably graduated Belmont like 2 years ago. And this guy looked me dead in the eye. We're having lunch in Nashville. Major label. And he's like, nobody, I just want you to know that nobody cares who owns songs anymore or who writes the songs. So it doesn't matter. Like, he was trying to get me to consider this thing. I was like, that is the only thing that matters.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, like, no, but we can do this and we can do that. And I was like, yeah, but like, that's like, anyways. So, but I feel like senior in college Phil, 21-year-old Phil, I don't think would have been as... I'm thinking about it in that way. I'm like, oh, cool label. Let's go.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So I think that like everything happens for a reason in the time that it does, because I've had so many friends in the industry that I've been like, oh man, I'm in my 30s and I'm just now getting out of this horrible management deal or this horrible, you know, rights situation. And you hear about that all the time. Like, oh, so-and-so, they don't own any of their master. So like what, so you might get you, all you're getting is you're just getting, the scraps off the table, you know. So I still own 100% of all my own publishing. I have my own publishing company. So like that has been a lifesaver for me. And so those are the kind of things like as a musician, like you love that you're getting attention or whatever it might be, but it's just like making the right call for your family and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Well, and two things come to mind in the news right now. Justin Bieber just sold his catalog I think it was $200 million.
That'll work.
Which is, yeah, I mean, good. If I was him, I'd be done. Hey,
let's go.
Bye.
Yeah,
see ya.
That's a whole different can of worms. But yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's like a big thing right now. People will sell their whole catalog, cash in, and be like, all right, I'm good. So yep, great.
I'm good. My friend Sahaj, who's the lead singer of the band Ra, he was on the podcast about 10 episodes ago or more, and we were talking about it, and he explained to me a similar story where I think it was Universal or Sony back in the 2000s. They were pretty big. They were all over rock radio, had some big hits. And, you know, it's funny. He was showing me posters where they were a headliner and like Shinedown was the opening act. You know, that's
cool. Yeah.
But so he went back to the president of the record label and asked if he could buy his masters. And they said, we'll look into it. And without going through all the gory details, something of the advance or whatever you were talking about they had given them, mm-hmm. or something with the merch they spent on the merch and everything in support of whatever hadn't been met yet, and he had to pay them back the rest of that amount before they 100%. Even consider 100%. Selling him his masters. And he was like
that's what people like. Yeah, like if you're the artist And the label's like, they get you your advance, you're signed to a deal, and you're like, you know what, I only want to stay in 5-star hotels. No problem. I only want to fly private. No problem. But guess who's paying that bill at the end of the day? Like, all that does is, like, you're not getting anything else out of that until 100% of that is paid back. Whereas, like, the best position, as I understand it, to be in is, like, you have a following you've built up, you've got support, you have songs that you've already recorded and that you own publishing to. And unless the deal makes a lot of sense to you financially, like it's a big number or whatever it means to you, then like you can have some confidence to go into that. But like, I feel like the beauty of this day and age is there's never been a better time to be an independent artist, because you can show these major labels that you can move the needle, you know, on your own. Like I can move the needle. I can go sell a show, or I can get X amount of followers or plays or whatever it might be. So like, what else can you do for me? And it used to be that the labels were the only people that could get you any exposure. So now the artist at least has some power to grow a real organic fan base, like an honest to God following. And then be like, okay, now you have some power at the negotiating table, which is what it's all about.
Social media and other outlets.
All that stuff. Yeah. 100%. Yeah,
I talked to a kid when I was still doing radio. He was telling me that he made some noise on SoundCloud and had a track on SoundCloud blow up and went viral. And he had all these record labels trying to I guess, entice him. And he took one up on a conversation. They flew him. Maybe it was Nashville. I forget where they flew him to. Maybe it was California.
Okay.
But anyways, when he walked in, excuse me, they had monitors, TV monitors, big, huge, like 85-inch TVs all through when you walk in behind the receptionist in these conference rooms. And his logo and his songs are playing on every TV, yeah, on everything all the way through. I mean, he had to walk all the way through this building to get to where they're having this meeting. And his logo and his songs are on everything he's passing. He's just like, whoa, I made it, you know. And they get him in, and they do a deal. And they kind of push him for like 3 months, and then nothing. He gets no support. No help, no nothing. Yeah. And so he started asking questions, and come to find out, they said if the way the record labels, and this is the way I understand it, the way the record labels look at things is if something gets hot on social media, whether it be SoundCloud or TikTok or whatever, they see you as unclaimed property. Yeah. And they want to get as much of that unclaimed property as fast as they can before their competition can get it. And then once they have it shored up, well, then they don't have to worry about their competitors coming in. And then they see if you're viable. And if you're not, they just let you rot on the show.
Or you competing with their other artists. I know people personally that like had a song that they wrote, like go crazy on social, and they got a record deal and the exact same thing. And what they didn't understand at the time was that the label took 15 of that person and put them all, like signed them all. And so like they all get about the equal support for the first few months. Then it's like, okay, which of these dogs can really hunt? You know, to pardon the West Virginia expression, but yeah, which of these dogs can really hunt? And then like, okay, these two are here. They're like, these are really crushing it. So let's put all the money now into these two. These other 13, just they can draw it on the shelf, and they're not competition. Mm-hmm. And you can't even go write your own stuff and release it because they own you for X amount of time. So they put you on the sideline for 3 years, 5 years. It's really crazy. So that's why I think the blessing of how things have happened now is that like I was still kind of holding on to this corporate thing. Like it's been remote. It's been, you know, very supportive, but you're not as dependent on, like, for example, if you're a 22-year-old and they say wave $100,000 in front of your face, like how do you ever say no to that?
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
You know, but like if you're a little more established and you can like take a second and just think through it and look at it from a long view, you know, like there probably needs to be more zeros there to make you consider something like that, you know? So anyways, it's just like, and I definitely don't have all the answers, but like, I've just been trying to be cautious with that because
that's very smart.
You can't be in music for 5 minutes without hearing somebody be like, oh man, like I had the worst deal I really got screwed by this company or whatever. So you just got to take it a day at a time, you know?
I think everyone in the music industry and even in the broadcast industry has their ups, their accomplishments,
for sure.
Also their,
for sure,
kind of their horror stories. Like I could tell you a radio company right now to just absolutely steer clear of. And I think everybody has that experience, you know?
Yeah. 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 So, that's
well, so man, true. I've had you on here for almost an hour. I'm so grateful for you talking to me, and I want to know more about where folks can find you. Obviously you've blown up on TikTok and Instagram.
Yeah, man.
They may already be there.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, but it's like Philip Boehm Music, correct?
Yeah, Philip Boehm Music. So one L in the Philip. So Philip Boehm Music is my handle on everything and also my website. So make it really easy. PhilipBoehmMusic.com. And then however you consume your music, whether it's Apple, Amazon, you know the drill, Spotify, blah, 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 blah. Let me tell you a great way to support your favorite independent artists that doesn't cost anything. What you do is you go follow them on those platforms and you put those little hearts beside their songs and you add their songs to your playlist, and it makes a world of difference to your favorite. Whether it's me or you, another musician that you love, that's a great way to support them. So however you listen to music, come find me and check out my stuff.
So not to put you on the spot, and
yeah,
I
please.
Can edit this out even.
Yeah.
But would it be outside the realm of possibility to hear you play a little fiddle before we wrap up? You have one close?
I have to just get out of the case and plug it in, but it's no big deal at all.
So we'll wrap up the podcast. We'll have you play us out. And yep. I don't know, man, you play what you want. I think being a West Virginia guy, maybe a little country roads, but
yeah,
you be the pick. I like what you did with Name and Goo Goo Dolls. So
we can do country roads.
Man.
We can do country roads because I don't have like a track with me right now, but like I just put a little bit of reverb on to make it like sound a little. So you can test the sound.
I love
like
reverb.
The fiddle is a. Does that sound okay?
Oh, it sounds great.
All right. I'm in tune enough. All right. For him.
Love it. That sounds so good too.
Yeah, man.
We're not going to end on that. We're going to talk about that. So what do you got there? What is that fiddle?
This is a Roth fiddle. It is almost 100 years old. And
whoa.
You know, these things are, this is definitely my most valuable instrument. But it's one thing about violins is, so if you want to get a quick idea of the craftsmanship and value of a fiddle,
sure.
If you see how you still have this beautiful like tiger stripe back, but it's all one piece.
Yes.
So sometimes you look at these and they'll have like a line down the back. And those can still be great instruments. But the hardest thing to do as the fiddle maker is to like have this stay as one piece and like be a one piece back. So that like tells you about craftsmanship. But like what these guys used to do or still do is that they owned a Stradivarius. So this guy owned a Stradivarius, a 1725 from Cremona. And what they would do is they would use that as their model. And so, like, this is a model of this Antonio Stradivarius from 1725. And a cool thing is I was fortunate enough to be in, like, Florence, Italy several years ago. And they had this fiddle, like, the one that it's modeled after, on display. And so I got a picture with, and it's, like, mine and that one, like, look exactly the same, except for his initials on the back.
That is incredible.
So, yeah, that's a, I got that instead of a vehicle when I went to college. So,
So how did you come across an almost century old instrument?
I went to this awesome violin shop called The Loft in Columbus, and I went with one of the people from that, like a teacher from the West Virginia Orchestra, the Symphony Orchestra, just went with me and my dad, and we spent the whole day in Columbus playing. You know, you go and you give them a general range of what you're looking for, and then spent the whole day playing through instruments, and then. So I've been playing this one for going on 20 years now. And so these only increase in value. So, you know, like this is a super valuable a piece of musical instrument. And it just sounds so pretty. And ones I played that day, I even liked that more than ones that were two or three times as much. I just love the sound of it. And so I've been playing that one for a long time. I got a few others, but that's my favorite one. Yeah.
That's amazing. Philip, thank you so much, man. I tell you what, when you release that record, please reach out to me. Maybe we'll do like a listening party or something.
Yeah, we'd love to. It's going to be like that all that kind of like Americana folk, alternate country kind of stuff. So I'll definitely send it your way.
And when you're here in May, reach out to me too. I'd like to come down and introduce myself. That'd be
okay,
great.
Yeah, be great. Anytime, man. That sounds awesome.
Philip, thank you so much, brother. That was incredible. I love listening to you play as well. That was awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on, and I will talk to you guys later on.